Studio, the podcast for writers and all who are interested in books, literature, and the printed word. Write on Audio is the weekly companion podcast of Write On Magazine and the Write On suite of publications from Pen to Print. Subscribe by searching Pen to Print in your favourite podcast app to have new editions delivered to you each week. Write On Audio interviews, inspiring you to write by sharing the experience of prominent authors. This month's interview is with playwright, actor, comedian and scriptwriter Jill Adams. In a highly successful career, Jill has had numerous stage and radio plays produced. She has been a writer in residence at the West Yorkshire Playhouse and at the University of Hull, and won a Fringe First Award. For television, Jill has written for Emmerdale and Doctors and appeared in the mockumentary Meet the Richardsons, in which she plays the mother of her real-life daughter, the comedian Lucy Beaumont. The interviewer is Lucy Kaufman, who was alongside Write On editor Madeline White.
So fantastic to have you here, Jill. I'm really pleased that you were able to join us today, especially as I know you've had COVID and you're recovering. So you're a playwright in your own right. You've written for TV and radio. You've won awards and Fringe First at Edinburgh Fringe. You're now better known as comedian Lucy Beaumont's real-life mum in TV's mockumentary Meet the Richardsons. And there's so much we could talk about today and so many areas I'm sure we could cover. So I'm going to begin by asking you, first of all, how you got into your writing journey.
Well, first of all, I have to say that when I was a kid, I was a slow reader. And we'll probably get into that a little bit, because obviously now I know that I've got autism and complex issues in that respect. So writing, actual physical writing and reading out loud was one of the most painful things for me. I would say, like, for a lot of years, it wrecked my life. But I knew that I could write, even though everybody was telling me I was illiterate and I was this and I was that. I knew I could write because from a very young age, I felt like I was a mind reader. I worked out at a really young age that people have secret thoughts in their heads. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, it used to scare me, but then it fascinated me. Mm. And I remember as a kid with a neighbour, it was snowing and it was thick snow outside and I'd cleared the snow for her. And she said, oh, come and knock on the door when you've finished and I'll give you a treat. And I went to knock on her door and the door was open and she was filling in a pools coupon. Do you remember pools?
Yeah, I do.
That's where you could win like big money in those days. And she was filling in a pools coupon and she shut her eyes and I could tell that she was like willing. I don't know whether it was God or what, but she was willing somebody to make a win. Yeah. And I remember thinking, I wonder what she would buy if she won it. Mm. And I went off into this big sort of like daydream of imagining her in a fair coat and looking like Elsie Tanner, because I was obsessed with Elsie Tanner from Coronation Street. I think that was the start of me becoming a writer in my head.
Yeah. Working out what she's thinking and putting yourself in her shoes and seeing it from her point of view.
Yeah, I've been fascinated by the fact that she had this part of her that we never saw. Yeah. And I used to sit on buses and they used to be like, say, an old woman sat opposite me. And I used to think, what's she imagining? Is she going home to a house full of cats? And is she a witch? And, you know, all these things. And it was, I don't know whether all kids did that, but I know that was my safe place in my head, even though I used to scare myself. It was where I used to go. I used to daydream. Yeah. And I was writing, but I was writing in my head.
So how about in the real world, how did you then translate that into writing plays?
So a lot of years passed. Obviously, I went to art college and I was sort of a set designer and I was more in the arts. It was that was what my natural ability was. My mum and dad were both art teachers. So my natural ability was, seemed like everybody kind of would say, you know, she's going to be an artist or she's going to be a designer. But that didn't kind of work out. I ended up coming back to Hull when Lucy was my daughter, when she was ready to start school. And we got a flat, a bed sit on Spring Bank. And quite simply, I was lonely. Mm. I couldn't afford to go out on a night. I never had a telly. I didn't have a lot of belongings even, because I'd come out of a marriage and I was left with very little. I was sort of starting again, really. And I started writing to keep me company. So I used to save my money up and I used to buy a book. I don't know why I didn't just go to the library, but I used to buy a book a week. And I bought a book about playwriting. I started sort of like experimenting, and then I bought Jim Cartwright, who actually is sort of a mate now. I bought his play Road.
Yeah.
And it just changed my life.
Yeah.
That and Morrissey lyrics, the lyrics from Morrissey the Smiths.
Yeah.
Those, the combination of those two things, I remember thinking I actually can write in my own dialect.
Yeah.
Even if I can't spell it, doesn't matter. I can just write the way I speak. And then I found a writing group which was short stories. And she said to me, your dialogue is overtaken. Have you tried writing plays? And I said, well, funny enough, I've got a play.
Yeah.
And she went, oh, what is that? I said, it's Jim Cartwright's Road. She went, no, I mean, have you thought about writing one? And so I started kind of writing on a night, and I'd go and sit in cafes during the day and imagine in my head I was a writer.
Yeah.
I didn't tell anyone.
Yeah.
But in my head I was imagining I was a writer. And for me, what a writer was just an observer during the day. You make notes and then you go home and write it all up. I felt like a detective. It changed my whole life. It gave me something that I felt was like a secret that nobody knew how clever I was. And one day I would just produce this marvellous play and it'd be put on and, I'd never look back. But, of course, it didn't work out like that. You have to. I did it myself, obviously.
But obviously you had that gift and you then realised that it was something you could translate onto the stage or into dialogue specifically.
I knew nothing about plays, though. I hadn't even seen one at that point.
No.
And yet I never even had the urge to go see one. I wasn't in love with theatre. I was just in love with the way you could bring a character to life and tell a story. That's what excited me. It wasn't that I wanted to bring it to life in a theatrical form.
No.
That came later.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you talk about Jim Cartwright because I wanted to speak about him later because I really see you as being kind of like a female equivalent, really.
I'll take that.
Yeah, but we'll talk about that in a minute. So obviously you're from Hull. I should say Hull, probably, shouldn't I?
Only if you're from Hull.
and so many of your plays are Hull based, and you and your daughter Lucy appear to have like a really strong Hull identity. And I know Lucy wrote Hull Roses, didn't she, recently? And in Meet the Richardsons, you go back to Hull, and there's a hilarious bit where you find a naked portrait of yourself in the charity shop, which I thought was just the most hilarious moment. So what extent do you see yourself as a sort of northern female writer or as a Hull writer, or do you simply see yourself as just a writer at the end of the day?
It's funny this, because for a lot of years, being a Hull writer, I felt held me back.
Right.
And I felt if I was actually living in the South, I'd probably be more successful. Nobody seemed to care to hear the Hull accent in any form, never mind actually in a play. At the time, the only sort of writers in Hull we had was like John Godber. And I mean, he might be based in Hull, but he was West Yorkshire.
Yeah.
And everything about his kind of world vision and stuff, it wasn't mine. That wasn't my experience. So I wanted to champion Hull because of that.
Yeah.
I didn't know what it was to be a Hull writer. I just knew what it was to be me. There was nobody else doing it. There was people doing a lot of poetry and there was people doing short stories, but there was nobody writing for theatre. And so I think that I kept it to myself for a long time until I knew that I had something, really. And that was a complete play. I kept it very sort of quiet. I had somebody who typed it up for me, and she was just a normal woman. She wasn't like, she'd never read a play in her life, but she used to ring me up laughing on the phone, saying, Jill, this is me when I was like, your age, or this is, oh God, that reminds me of so-and-so. But this woman, I don't think she would say that. I think she would say this. So I had sort of input from ordinary people that were related to writing in any way whatsoever. She just put me straight on a few things. She'd say, well, this woman's in her 50s. And I think when you're in your 50s, you're more like this. And so I had like I had a bizarre mentor because she was like, she'd been a good time girl at Lynn. And she was all blousy and she was all blonde and busty. And she became really a lot of my lead characters. I kind of like always went to that place. And I remember once going to a club with her. And as we got nearer and nearer to the front of the queue to get in, she just turned into this like good time girl that was like extraordinary and sort of like turned round to me and said, "Hey, Jill, ask me." I said, "Asked you what?" She said, "Ask me if I care." I said, "Do you?" She said, "Do I F?" And that was it. I knew I had a play called Ask Me If I Care. Yeah. And I knew it was based on this woman who had been a good time girl and still thought she was. But she was older and things, her life had changed and she was still hanging on to that thing that we all do, because I do it now. She wanted to be noticed. She was all about her bust. It was all about her bust. And this was pre like having your boobs done and everything. But but that was her identity. And I loved that.
I was going to ask you actually whether what you write is autobiographical.
It never is.
No.
I think what it always is the kind of people I find more interesting than me. If you was to walk into a pub and there's a woman at the bar holding court, you know, sort of pissed out of her head, you know, that's the person I'm going to write about. You know, it's not going to be me, ever me, you know. And that's why I kind of, because, you know, I've discovered, like, I'm doing more acting and stuff. I've discovered that I do have this part of me that, and I think it's my granny as well. My granny was like a club singer and my granny was blousy and she was a barmaid and she was busty. And I'm kind of turning into my granny now, I'm this age. But at the time I thought, I'll never be like that. No. I'll never be that type of woman. Even when I was younger, I never thought I would relate physically to what it's like to be sexy with the bust and all that. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. It was like, I was such a child, very immature for a lot of years, that I never saw myself as a woman. Therefore, I would always write about other people.
When I spoke to you the other day, you were saying that you find it easy to write for male characters as well.
Yeah.
And that you can put yourself equally into sort of male or female characters when you write. So tell me a little bit more about your writing process when you get into a character.
Well, what comes to me first always is a sense of what is it, the one, and years later you taught this, you know, but I didn't know that it was just a normal process for me. But I used to always think what people say isn't necessarily what they want, you know, and what they want isn't necessarily what they need. And so I always think of either an injustice or a dilemma. So the dilemma or the injustice comes first.
Right.
And then I kind of like, and then I'm off, really, to put everything in their way to stop them from getting what they want. And also to test them and to push them and to work out whether they're capable of overcoming this problem or whatever. And then I get under their skin. I do a lot of research. If it's based on a true story, then obviously I've done tons of research at that point. And I kind of get to know them to the point where I can put them in any situation and I'll know how they respond. Even sitting on the loo, I'll know how they respond. I get under their skin and it makes no difference whether they're male or female. No difference whatsoever. I physically feel them.
Yeah.
I mentally see them, and I know that if I throw something at them, I know they're gonna react.
Yeah,
at least I think so. But sometimes when I start writing, they react in a different way to what I expected. So I don't know where that comes
because
in.
They become real, don't they? They become real people with their own impetus. It's almost like they do actually exist, and we just see them.
It is uncanny, isn't it? It is like, you know. I mean, I've written stuff like, and I've read it back, and I thought, how do I know that? And I think, well, I don't know that. That's the character that knows that.
Yeah, absolutely.
That isn't me. I kind of just understand why they're like they are, and quite often I get to the end of something before I realise why they're like they are.
Yeah.
With Off Out, I've done tons of work with prostitutes. Yeah. I'd even gone on the streets with prostitutes. I got as close to that job And so with my character of June, when I was writing Off Out, she did some really mean things to her son, the way she left him, the way she was, really. She was kind of like, because she'd had such a hard time, she was a bit greedy with money. There was loads of things about her I didn't like. I knew people a bit like that. Loads of things I didn't like about her. But she made me laugh. And a lot of the women that I'd met, the prostitutes that I'd met, there were actually a couple of them were dead. They'd been murdered in the process between me meeting them and then me producing the play and the play being out there. During that time, they'd been murdered. So it was like a really weird feeling. So I could no longer sort of like go to them and ask them questions. I just had this thing where I knew. Not only are they in a dangerous world, the danger, everything around them is pretty toxic. And that shifted my gear. So when I came to write towards the end of the play, there's this sort of a speech where she says to her son, he couldn't understand why she left him when he was a kid with his granny, who she knew was a bitch, horrible person, the granny. And she left him with him. And he couldn't understand why she never came back for him. And she said, the longer you stay away, the harder it is to come back. And I knew when I wrote that, that had come from the process, the journey of writing the story, because that wasn't something I knew was going to be the reason behind everything. And I understood it. I totally understood that she'd stayed away for that long. She couldn't come back. And every time she just never had that opportunity to come back and say, I'm doing all right.
And that's the wonderful thing about writing, isn't it? Is that you discover things as you go along. And I always love it when I'm surprised by something in the writing, that something comes out that I could never have planned before I'd started it. It's a wonderful process.
It's like they say that, well, the high conscious kicks in, but I don't think it's that. I just think we're like a computer. We've worked it all out. I think you work it out when you're asleep. I've gone to bed knowing I need an ending for something, like, and I've gone to bed maybe 3 nights, and then on the fourth night, I've woke up with the ending absolutely clear as a bell,
Conscious has
visually.
been
I've
working away on it, hasn't it, while you're not
so
even.
like behind the scenes, you know. And I do, and the thing is, I never write for myself. I always write for the characters. They say you should write for the audience, but I always write for the characters to get their story out.
So you're talking about Off Out, and that's the one that you won the Fringe first for, isn't it, at
Yeah, I
Edinburgh?
won a Fringe Fest for that. Yeah, and it was bittersweet, really, because as I say, by the time I put it on in Edinburgh, the women that had helped me, that had inspired it, were, you know, there was a murder investigation going on, and it was all a bit, although it wasn't their story, their personal sort of like actual story, so much of their life was in my characters that it was a funny feeling. I felt like they only existed now in the play. When we put it on in Hull, when they were still alive, these two women, they came to see it, and they left in the interval, and I thought, oh no, they ate it. They ate it. I've insulted them, or, you know, they don't like the way I changed the names and stuff. And it was funny, you see, because a lot of my stuff is dark comedy, so it's funny. You're laughing, and you shouldn't be laughing, really, but you kind of can't help it. And I thought, oh, they're insulted. I went and looked for them, and I said, I'm really, you know, what? Why did you leave? You know, and went, what do you mean? I said, why did you leave in the interval? And they said, what do you mean, the interval? I said, well, the interval is like you go and have a drink and go to the toilet and come back, and there's another act, there's like a second act. And they went, oh, we didn't know. And I said, well, where did you go? So basically, they watched the first act and went back out and did
Thought
some
that was the
work.
end. Because we spoke about that the other day, didn't we? Then I was
Yeah.
like, I didn't understand why you're not as known as Jim Cartwright, John Cooper, because to me your writing is equivalent as
Well, it's quite simply that I was kept out the theatre for a good like 20 years. I've got friends now that are actors, and they're actors because they read one of my plays when they were young. And I think that's absolutely amazing, but it also makes me very sad for the years where there was a couple of other generations of young people that might have wanted to become actors had they read my play. And I know Lucy feels the same about stand-up, part of the reason she was like wanting to do stand-up was because there was no representation of female voice or the female vision, the world, her world, you know.
We were thinking, weren't we, that it's
and
because
it
you're
so
a woman
wrong.
that you didn't achieve that same status that these other male writers
Yeah.
achieved.
Well, they hate it, don't they? They hate it when you say it's because I was a woman, but what was the reason? I could put bums on seats. I was getting the most amazing reviews, like reviews you die for.
Yeah.
I went on to produce stuff myself because I couldn't get plays on. And I was taking on a bank loan, taking plays to Edinburgh and winning all the awards.
Yeah.
And then having to like write on Emmerdale for a couple of years to pay the debt off. It was all wrong.
Yeah.
And yet it became right for me because I found a way of still doing my craft.
Yeah.
And never let it put me off. I didn't even try other theatres. I didn't bother. I was given a residency at the West Yorkshire Playhouse for a while, but it was kind of too little too late.
Yeah.
I was in the wrong frame of mind at that point. I just needed to earn money because I had a daughter that was coming up to being a teenager. I was under a lot of pressure to earn proper money, you know, not just like £4,000 a year or whatever, you know.
Absolutely.
And so
because
I was
you're
kind
a
of...
proper working writer, you're a proper writer that has to do it.
I was,
living.
Yeah, and I knew my daughter wanted to go to uni. I had no money. I was still living in rented accommodation. I was still in debt because of the loans I took out to sort of produce my work. And I did reach a point where I thought, this can't, it can't be meant to be. It's just like, it's too hard. It's too hard to make a living.
I know that now you're taking a slightly different tack now where you are just taking some of your older plays and reviving them. So Fish and Leather, you've had a recent revival of. How many years later is that from the original?
Oh, no. Don't ask. I'm so old. 32 years ago, I wrote Fish and Leather.
32?
Yeah, I'm that old.
Yeah.
I was in my 20s when I wrote it, in my 30s when I directed it, in my 40s and 50s when I was in it myself, playing the character of Leather, and in it again in my 60s now.
Wow.
But yeah, the reason, it's quite simple. I need to earn money, you know, and the best way to earn money for me at the moment, I saw a gap in the market where I became good friends with Sarah Crombie, who kind of manages the Fish and Leather Tour. We're calling it like a tour at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
She manages it, and she's been a landlady for a lot of years. And I had a really interesting conversation with her where she said people really want to go to pubs now and experience pubs and clubs in a different way. After COVID, they became dead. And there was a lot of places where they had back rooms that they never ever used anymore.
Yeah.
And it's not enough for them to just come to a pub and have something to eat or listen to, like, even just stand-up comedy is different for some pubs. And I thought, I like that. I like the thought of taking something into areas where it's dead. And pubs that maybe were originally, like when we did it at Rainer's, I remember Rainer's in the day, it was heaving that place. You know, you literally it was like a sea of people whenever you went in it, and you're lucky if you get three people sitting there, like now, unless there's a rugby match on or a big football match on. A lot of them have become sports bars, they've become male dominated again. So I thought, how can we do that? Well, the thing about Fish and Leather was, I would say, the first play I lent my voice properly.
Yeah.
Because although I'd written Don't Ask Me If I Care, I never produced that one. So Fish and Leather was my second play that I wrote where I knew I'd found my voice. I knew it was unique, and I knew it wasn't like Jim Cartwright's.
No.
In as much as it was very Hull. And although I used like verse, you know, I used poetry within it the way he does and stuff like that, because I love that direct. It's so direct when you write something that is poetic. It's like a a direct link to the soul. And so I knew I could cast it, like with a small cast, and it's doable because there's only a cast of three. And I thought, if I play leather, then I'll only have to pay two actors. I mean, it was honestly doing the math.
Oh yeah, you do with theatre, don't you? It's all about.
I ain't got a pension. Yeah, I ain't got a pension, and I ain't got savings.
No.
And I need to, like, you know, earn money, and it was purely for the money initially. But it's become this thing now where it's like we've got a following, got a fan base, and wherever we put it, the same people come back.
Oh wow!
So even if because we do it, we was doing it every month. Two or three nights every month, and I thought that's enough to take it to different. We call it Fish Talk because we're taking it East Hull, North Hull, West Hull, Central Hull, they're into South Hull. That's Lincoln. I don't know whether it's the same in every city, but depend where you whether if you live in East Hull, you're very different mentality to if you live in North Hull, and if you live in West Hull, you're a different mentality to people in East Hull. It's very different, and some of that is because of the rugby. I don't know what it is. It's just a kind of class thing. It is just even the voices are a bit different.
Yeah.
Because you get it in places like Liverpool.
But to me, theatre is that communication between the writer and the audience, or the actors and the audience. It is that magic that happens when you put real live people in front of real live people, and something extra happens that's not in the script. You know, it's like.
Yeah.
It's just that engagement that, you know.
Well, we can change it. We can keep changing it as well, you know. We changed something because we had a poke at Camilla because I ain't a royalist. So we had a poke at her, and it was like, and that is kind of like that sort of cabaret feel where you're like, but you're on the nose politically, or you're the Zegas. You're on the nose. You kind of, you capture what people are thinking and don't say. Yeah. And so we used to get like literally like almost a standing ovation after that tiny little section.
Yeah.
Like we just
that's what's wonderful.
But not
as well,
Camilla, actually. No. And then we used to wave and then give it the finger. It's all that's all it was. But they used to love it.
Yeah.
Even if there was royalists, which
again,
you know,
it's releasing something that's there, isn't it, in that moment? But to me, that's theatre as well, is that it can be so topical because you can literally write it. Or improvise it in the moment. And...
Exactly. Well, that's what we do, you see. Yeah. We're given that.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I don't, when I'm in it, because I'm in it, I don't relate as a writer.
Mm.
Although I'm going away and changing things and rewriting things and stuff, I'm not relating as a writer. I'm relating as the actress. I'm relating as you have an understanding of your own work so much differently when you're in it.
Yeah.
It's a completely different experience.
Yeah, interesting.
I'm not asking them to do anything I'm not doing myself.
No, absolutely. I think it does sometimes help, doesn't it, to have some experience of having acted if you're going to write for the stage. I mean, I have as well had experience of acting and being in plays and understanding the mechanics of it.
Yeah.
Really help with writing.
And knowing when you need to have, when it's too wordy or you're doing this too much.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're looking at, you're playing ping pong, knowing when you need to physically break it up.
When I teach playwriting, I tell people to just get something on so they can go and sit in the audience and experience it with the audience, because that's how you learn, isn't it? When you...
Totally.
You know where it gets a bit boring and the audience is shuffling a little bit, or you know where... they're laughing, and you know that you've really shaped it where you've got them to cry at a certain moment, really being so in tune with the audience and what they're experiencing is just priceless, isn't it? It's just,
we know when it doesn't work, don't you? It's like it hits you in the face when when it works, it's magic, it takes you out yourself, doesn't it?
But
it's a funny profession, I think. To make a living as a writer is totally different from being a writer.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily, if you're not making a living, they think that you're not a writer anymore. But actually, it's like with me, maybe not so much now, but it used to be like a drug. It was like a habit. I couldn't, there was no cure for it. the only cure for it was writing every day.
Yeah.
And I've like put myself through this, like, well, I'm not getting paid for it.
Yeah.
You know, nobody will maybe even read this, but I've got to get it out and I've still got to do it.
Absolutely.
That's gone a little bit now, I have to say. I don't have that urge anymore to write every single day. Yeah. I feel as though I've got a backlog of stuff I want to revisit.
Yeah.
Rather than creating new stuff, I think.
Yeah.
I think the great thing is when you've got a group of people that you know you can rely on.
Yeah.
As long as they're available, you can do great things as a writer. If you find those people that are going to do justice to your work, whether you're part of it, being in it or not, hang on to them, because you only learn through other people. I think you kind of, it's other people that show you when something works or not. You say, those scratch nights, I think, are brilliant.
Yeah,
you know, where you hear you play read out loud and stuff. I'm all for those kind of things. I think anyone can write. You know, I do get people going, "Oh, that's not true." Anybody can write, but not everybody can write something that is good enough to be performed. Do you know what I mean? It's but we can all write. I mean, you see it on Facebook. People are writing every day. They're writing. Arranging the words to have an effect. They either want us to feel sorry for them, or they want us to laugh at them.
They want us to think this or think that, and they are manipulating us with their words. So they are writing.
Yeah.
They just don't realise that that's what they're doing.
I was just going to ask you about Meet the Richardsons, really.
Because
at this stage of your life, I imagine that that's come as quite a surprise to you, that there's this whole other thing that you're part of that is, again, riotous and fun and... if you'd like to talk a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, this is the fifth year, so every summer for 5 years I've been going and living this kind of surreal life with my son-in-law and daughter, and she's obviously, Lucy's written it, but the way it's written is kind of like it's the storyline.
Mm.
And where it comes to our dialogue, unless it's something you have to say because it feeds the story in, you know, really in an important way, it's kind of improvised. And I think a lot of my, because I'm just really good at improvisation, and so is Lucy and John, we just have this rapport between us, you know. I think it comes from being a writer.
Yeah.
I think because I'm a writer, I know, I just have this ability to say the most outrageous thing or the right thing or the wrong thing, you know what I mean? I think that
is the dialogue as well, isn't it? It's that kind of,
it just pops in the head that
dialogue can have sometimes.
There's no thought process. I'm totally reacting to the situation, and I love that escape. I have to say, we've just done the series 5, it won't quite the same this time round because they know what they want now.
Yeah.
And so they're kind of editing it as the film in it sort of thing. And that, and so there's not as much play.
Right.
Before, we could do a scene 3 or 4 times and we would just play with it.
Yeah.
And you got fabulous stuff. Now we know our characters well enough.
Yeah.
To do it faster.
Yeah.
So it isn't quite the same. But I mean, it's weird. I get like spotted on trains and all over now. I have people coming up to me and going, "Oh, we love you in the show, blah blah blah." So are you really a mother? And I was like, "Yeah." And I really like that. And I'm like, well, because a lot of it is true. A lot of it is based on truth. So it's kind of heightened reality.
Yeah, heightened
reality. But it's just another form of entertaining. I love entertaining people.
Yeah.
And I love making people laugh. I think when you've made them laugh, you've got license then to really sort of like move them as well.
Okay, so for the readers of our magazine and for our listeners of this podcast who might be ordinary people from all kinds of backgrounds and they might lack the courage to get something down on paper, what would you have to say to those readers and listeners?
Try it out on your friends.
Mm-hmm.
Try it out on your friends. You know, don't keep it to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would say, like, you know, don't keep it to yourself. Get it written down and try it out on your friends. And if it makes your friends laugh, and if if you can trust that they're not just going to suck up to you, that's the key. Finding somebody that you know is blatantly like going to tell you the truth, you know, because they you know they're not going to. Do you know what I mean? There is this thing, particularly with amateur dramatics, where everybody says everything's marvellous and it isn't. They don't make it marvellous. Mm. It just makes them saying it's marvellous. Because the thing is, if you want to do it, you'll find yourself just doing it. Yeah. There is no like, I'll do it tomorrow. You just find yourself doing it. And then before you know it, you can't stop doing it. And then it's the thing you think about the minute you wake up. It's the thing that you look forward to when everyone's gone to bed.
Yeah.
And you start viewing the world differently and it just takes over you. And if that starts to happen to you, then, you know, go for it, because if it's in you, you can't stop it forever.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I always say. I can't not write. So it's like I have to write. Yeah.
What a brilliant way of coming to the end of the interview. And it's just really, you know, Jill, when Lucy spoke to you yesterday, she said, oh, everybody needs some Jill in their lives, you know, shouting themselves. And I can only, you know, I honestly, it's just been really inspiring. I haven't written creatively for a while now because of the sense of failure. And you know, it's I think the liberation I hear in you is it's just really, really inspiring.
The thing is about writing though, and this fear of failing is you've got to get it wrong before you can get it right. That is fact. Even no matter who you are, you might be Sarah Phelps, who's one of the highest telly writers. I know she goes through 5 drafts. You never get it right straight away, but there's always enough within what you're writing that excites you to keep going. But, you know, there's no such thing as failing. There's just, it's not right now. But that doesn't mean to say tomorrow you're not going to turn a corner with it. That's what's brilliant. There's always an answer.
Thank you to Jill Adams for being the subject of our August interview. As usual, we'll post links so you can find out more about Jill and her work in the show notes for this podcast. We're always delighted to read your contributions. So if you'd like to see your words in Write On or hear them on this podcast, please get in touch. We'll share this link and all others mentioned in today's podcast as part of our show notes. I've been Tiffany Clare, and you've been listening to Write On Audio. Write On Audio is produced by Chris Gregory, and it's an alternative stories production for pen to print. This podcast is supported using public funding by Arts Council England.